Warning, 30 Screams or Less may contain spoilers about movies that have recently been released. If you haven't seen the movie, go watch it, come back, and enjoy the show. Or, if you don't want to waste your time watching the movie and rather have two random horror dudes watch it for you, we got you covered as well. Welcome everyone to 30 Screams or Less, a horror movie podcast where we review horror movies in 30 minutes or less. Today we have a little something different here. We're actually sitting down with Martin Portlock of Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare, and he can also be seen in the viral performance from Britain's Got Talent as his portrayal of the witch. But before we get into it, Corey, last night I was looking in the mirror and you know what? My beard was looking gnarly. And I said to myself, I can't look like this. I gotta do something. So I decided to break out Beard Octane's beard wash and conditioner along with their beard oil, and dude, my beard looked amazing. I'm glad you turned me on to Beard Octane.
Yeah, of course. Like I said, I've been using their products for years and I can vouch for them. And whether you're pounding IPAs or chopping wood, you gotta look your best. Visit beardoctane.com and use the code 30screams10 at checkout for a 10% discount. It helps us. And like I said, the products are absolutely incredible. They're local too. They're based out of Connecticut. So help them out, support small businesses. We're not just slinging beard grooming supplies. We've been using them for a while.
Yeah, we have. Martin, thank you so much for sitting with us today. It is a pleasure.
Oh, that's my pleasure, guys. It's always a pleasure to speak to people and do podcasts. I love it.
We love it too. And first thing first, your portrayal of Peter Pan in Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare was unreal.
Oh,
absolutely
thanks,
unreal. No problem. As soon as I saw you on screen, I was immediately blown away. Obviously, like, the quality and everything in the movie looked fantastic. It looked like it could be a big budget film. But then when I saw you doing your thing at the circus and coming out of the trap door there, I was like, oh God, this guy's got star material all over him.
Thanks, man. Yeah. No, actually, that was my favorite scene, the circus. They actually cut so much out of the movie, but it was one of my favorite scenes. And it was so dark and it was so twisted, you know, because you've got this wonderful family event going on and this psycho, you know, this unknowing psycho just stood there as a mime. And I did an entire mime act, which they ended up cutting from the film. I think it was just like due to time and stuff like that. And then, you know, going into that kind of creepy point, trying to choose which child I wanted, you know. But that was one of my favorite scenes, the energy and the being in that circus and with the crowd, because there was real crowds in there. It was an experience. It was amazing.
Oh, I bet. Now, I was kind of wondering about that too, because it was so quick. How come they cut out so much of that part? I would have loved to have seen Peter Pan do like this whole monologue deal in front of the crowd. I think that would be an interesting take. And then like it develops into like more of the standard Peter Pan character that we know of. So it almost felt like it was just kind of thrown there real quick. And then like we didn't get that full approach to that scene.
No, I think in terms of the, you know, length of the film, I know they had to make some cutbacks for time. And although the scene was amazing and there was all this detail within this circus scene, there was nothing really that pushed the story forwards. It was more like a bit of backstory, you know, where's he from? And it would all end up coming back to the simple fact that, okay, he's a mime or a clown and he works at the circus and he's choosing his victims there. So as soon as we managed to get that point across, there was like the rest of it, any other performances or anything like that, it was kind of irrelevant story-wise. And there were so many other moments within the story that needed to be shown as priority.
Okay, now that makes sense. If it's not going to drive the story, then it can really throw things off.
Exactly, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, so that makes perfect sense now, but...
Don't get me wrong, I would love to see an extended edition. I think there might even be deleted scenes and stuff that may have been put in on the DVD, but I don't know that yet, because my copy is about to arrive on Monday.
Oh, nice. So you're getting the advanced copy, obviously.
Well, I'm hoping so.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, you're only a star of the film. Like, oh, geez, I guess I'll just get it on video on demand.
I guess sent a DVD instead of a Blu-ray.
No. Oh, what? Don't even get the Blu-ray. Oh,
no, God. I will. I've got the Blu-ray coming. But...
Good. Get that Steelbook, too. I don't know if there is Steelbook. But I love steelbooks. I talk about them all the time. And Corey's like, I don't do DVDs or Blu-rays and stuff.
There's a wonderful company. I think it's called Umbrella Entertainment. For your fans and stuff, anyone who likes this movie.
Oh, yeah.
They're based in Australia. And they are doing a limited edition release with a Peter Pan storybook and official cover and everything for the Blu-ray release. It's got like loads of original artwork and stuff for it. So if you're a collector of horror movies, then go and have a look on their social media. Umbrella Entertainment, they call it, I think.
Yeah.
And they've got their website where they sell all these limited edition releases.
The first time I had actually heard about them was with Terrifier 3. They did that really, really big box set for it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that they're going to do one for Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare, because I'm probably going to go check that out. Because the storybook thing, I love it. Between, you know, Blood and Honey and this, the way that it opens with the storybook, we're both huge fans of that.
Yeah.
It's
a lovely little twisted thing. And Scott was great, you know, working with Scott. He had a very clear vision for Peter Pan, you know, and I think so many people have been, you know, in anticipation of thinking like, oh my God, are we going to get like a horrid Disney version of Peter Pan killing people? We don't want this. But actually, you know what? It's his own take on a real person who says he's Peter Pan, who has this twisted belief in the real world, you know? And we thought, well, if you've got somebody like that in the real world who believes these things and he's a psycho and he's kidnapping children and worse, what kind of reality would that be in this world? So I think Scott, you know, very much delved deep into that psychology of these characters and threw them into this dark film. I mean, this film is not like the other movies they've made. It's got its own kind of pace and own kind of like feel about the movie. You know, it's not like Blood and Honey 2, you know, it's fast action and lots of thrills and lots of kills. Pan's paced.
It absolutely is paced. We loved it. That actually was one of my main questions, because we reviewed it last week. Again, we thought it was amazing. If you haven't listened to the episode, we gave it a 5 out of 5. We both loved it. So,
oh, great.
Yeah, it was great. That was actually one of my main questions was, is he really Peter Pan or is he just a psychopath who thinks he's Peter Pan? And all these things that he's thinking, like seeing in a Peter Pan flying around and as a shadow, or him floating, is all purely in his head.
Yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
So this was actually a question. When I first read the script, this was a question I thought heavily on. And I was trying to, I spoke to Scott about it. And we thought to ourselves, you know, this guy's high on drugs. He's, you know, imagining these higher beings and higher power. But he's taken such a beating and he's clearly got this energy about him. And he's absolutely adamant that he wants to get back into Neverland, which then sprung the question, you know, does he been there before?
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had. I think he had been there before, maybe when he was younger. You know, there's a lot of question marks over his childhood. There's a lot of question marks about his mother, who he mentions in the movie. There's a lot of question marks over what happened to him physically. I don't know if you recall, but there was a bit of a naked scene for Peter Pan.
Oh, we recall. And I was literally just going to chime in. I was going to wait until you done.
He's got nothing down there, you know. There's nothing there.
We actually brought this up on our review. We were like, what's going on? He's like a Ken doll.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to bet question what happened to this guy. And I think anything that had happened to him in the past made him who he is today. And that was wonderful, you know, working with Scott and trying to figure out that psychology. And sorry, I'm going on, but to answer your question, I would say anything's possible, you know, especially in this twisted childhood universe that creating. You know, they got Winnie the Pooh, and I think Mary Poppins is coming in somewhere.
Nice.
I think, you know, and we got Tinkerbell and all that kind of stuff. So I'd like to think that Neverland is real for him. And I think it would go deeper as well. I would like to see Peter Pan in his prime. You know, when he's in Neverland and he's got his power and he's back to his full strength and he's able to fly and he's able to do things. I mean, I can't imagine the villain if he could do those things. But I'm going to be looking forward to seeing that in this Pooniverse film, because I'm coming back for it.
Oh, nice. I can't wait. We were talking like there's going to be a sequel. There has to be. Based on the way it ended, it was wide open for a sequel. And we did have some questions regarding like the actual plot itself, and like going back to the whole full frontal scene, it's not even really full frontal because there's nothing there.
No.
So it's just straight Ken doll. I was thinking to myself, okay, well, maybe he had a traumatic childhood. Perhaps his parents cut it off. Like, they were psychopaths. They cut it off thinking that it's going to stop him from growing. And then, you know, there was nothing ever there. We don't know. I was just kind of like theorizing about some of these scenarios. And like you said, everything's up for a kind of interpretation. And like, you can kind of form your own opinion on like what's going to happen. And we love that.
I think he hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I'm a big advocate of people in the audience trying to make up, you know, their own idea of what's going on. I don't believe that the movie and the script and the storyteller should tell everything to the audience. I think there's certain things that they need to kind of figure out themselves or help make them wonder, because ultimately that is something that enthralls you. And while you're watching the movie, because your brain's constantly working, it becomes good entertainment when your brain's ticking over. But if you're told everything in one go, it's just like, oh, well, don't need to see it now, do I? You know, you lose interest. You know what's happened. You know what's going
on. Yeah, you know what happens, and there's nothing you really need to say to anyone, or like there's no real discussion you can open up with people regarding it.
Exactly.
It's just kind of open shut. That's it. If you're giving away everything. Now, don't get me wrong. I like when, well, let's say TV shows, right? TV shows will have this whole long story, and at the end, they might tie up every single loose end, and that's it. That's one thing. Like, for instance, Breaking Bad tied everything up in a nice bow at the end. And yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm good. I don't need to see anything else. Like, nothing is up for debate anymore. We just know. So that was a nice, like, exclamation point, done. But I do like when movies make you think and make you actually want to have a discussion about them. Because if we showed this movie to someone else, I would end up going into the, I thought he was a psychopath and that all of this is in his mind. And then someone might say, no, I think he is Peter Pan, but he went crazy because of it or something. You know, there's like room for interpretation and actual discussion regarding the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, and this is something I don't think I've actually said this to anyone before, but just read the title of the movie. It's Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare. It's a nightmare. He's in a nightmare. And, you know, he's Peter Pan, but it's a Neverland nightmare. It's not Peter Pan goes to Neverland. It's not Peter Pan. It's his Neverland nightmare. And I think that when you think about the title of the film and then you relate it to what happens in the movie, I think you can kind of agree that it is just like a dream state nightmare, the whole movie. It all parents' worst scenario happens within that film. The one guy that you would never want to meet in your entire life is in this movie. He is the stuff of nightmares. So yeah, when I say to anyone, what's the film about? And I said, it's about Peter Pan's Neverland nightmare. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, maybe he's a kid in actual Neverland dreaming of this whole scenario, like this whole nightmare scenario. Now we're back in.
Don't say that. They'll recast me. They'll get some kid to come in.
Okay. I'm edit.
Edit that one out.
Edit.
No, it's still good.
So, yeah, let's not get you recast. And we ain't doing that. Okay. So, I want to kind of dive into some of these questions here. You know what? I'm going to have Corey start with some of his questions. So, Corey, you had a few questions.
Yeah. So, I just want to start with having you tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into acting?
Wow. Okay. It's not really a long story. I think it's kind of the same story that, you know, a lot of actors have. You know, you feel when you're in a job and you're generally working and then you feel like there's something missing or this isn't, you know, what I wanted to do with my life or that kind of crap. And I love film. I love film and television. You know, when I was younger, I used to watch movies with my mother and my father. We always used to go up to my nan and granddad's for Christmas, and there used to be Indiana Jones and Star Wars on the telly, and we'd do nothing but watch these holiday movies, you know, and they enthralled me. And I grew up in that era where, you know, some of the biggest blockbusters that were coming out were like the original Ghostbusters and Labyrinth and Willow and, you know, that kind of time frame. And I loved the creativity of those movies and I wanted to be involved somehow, but I never really knew in what capacity. I used to watch the behind the scenes and how they used to make, you know, the little models and characters and Yodas and Gremlins and all that kind of stuff. And I used to love that. But it wasn't until a lot later in life that I realized that it was the performance element of those characters that I had fallen in love with. And it took me a long time to realize that I wanted to be an actor. And then when I did, I finally gave up my job at hospital. I used to be a healthcare professional. I used to work in operating theater. And I thought, right, you know what? That's it. I'm not doing this anymore. I want to do what I want to do. So I did. I quit my day job, went into full-time acting, applied myself to everything and anything I could, found my niche, you know, found a bit of my calling. And a few years later, here I am.
Oh, that's so cool. So ultimately, like, your inspiration, I guess you could say, is that you've always kind of loved movies. But then you got to this point in your life where you're just kind of in this dead-end job. Or I wouldn't even say a dead-end job, because it's a good job. But it wasn't what made you happy. And like,
yeah,
that's
it was a great job, but it was a bad job for me because it wasn't fulfilling my soul, you know?
That's right. And, you know, they say a lot of things about like, filling your cup. Have you ever heard this kind of saying?
Yeah.
Yes. So it almost sounds like that job was not filling your cup, or it was like taken away from your cup, and it was just causing you to just be like, I don't want to do this. This ain't what I'm built for. I want to be an actor. I want to be in movies. Yeah. So, you know what? I'll kind of expand upon that question. So was it movies that were your biggest inspiration, or was there like an actor in particular that you saw and you were just like, yes, this is the pivotal moment where I realized that I want to do this for a living?
I was heavily drawn to comedy elements in movies originally. I don't know if you're familiar with James Bond.
Of course.
You know, they had Roger Moore, right, and his little eyebrow that he used to raise. And he really added the comedy element to those movies. And I was a massive fan of that. And then you got Bill Murray, obviously, adding the comedy elements to a lot of his movies. Ghostbusters, you know, he was the comedy element in Ghostbusters. So everyone was instantly drawn to him. Yeah, and I think like Harrison Ford as well in that time, when he was a lot younger, doing Indiana Jones and adding the comedy elements to Indiana Jones in his unusual circumstances really kind of drew me into acting initially. And then it kind of developed over time, and I was like, oh, no, I like characterization. I like doing creepy characters, and I like doing a bit of drama. You know, I like feeling the emotion from some of these characters. And that's where I started experimenting, you know, and ultimately that's where I managed to get my role as the witch on Britain's Got Talent, which was this really dark, creepy guy, but not a guy.
No one really knew who he was.
You know, it was kind of, what was this thing? And I loved that. I love creating that kind of character. And yeah, it's just the essence. It's the essence of character generation and acting and expression.
Oh, that's awesome. Corey, actually, you have a question about Britain's Got Talent and The Witch. So you can expand on that.
Kind of leading into that, can you talk about your appearance on the show as The Witch? I mean, we kind of briefly talked about this before, but the videos on YouTube just have millions and millions and millions of views. Like, what was that experience like?
I've never been so nervous in my entire life, but it was a good nervous, you know, it was like an excited energy. So I had to go for a prosthetic casting of my head for a movie called Wolf Manor. I think you guys know it as Scream of the Wolf.
Yep.
My head got chopped off in this movie, right? So I had to go and get this head cast done. And I was speaking to the prosthetic team and they said, do you know what, Martin, you've got a very interesting face. And I was like, oh, thank you very much. they said, well, actually, we've got this character that we're doing with Britain's Got Talent. And I was like, oh, really? That sounds interesting. What is it? And he goes, it's a witch. And they had the audition with this guy dressed up as a witch doing an apple trick. And he couldn't do it anymore. So he went through and did like the audition, got through. But for the semi-finals, they didn't have anyone to go and take his place. So they asked me to do it. So then I spent the next few months generating a new witch character. They did all the prosthetics for me. And then the next thing I know, I'm live on national television, on stage, doing magic on my own, which I've never done before in my life, by the way. Okay, I was not a magician.
Okay.
I had never done magic before in my life. And I had a magic consultant who was training me over a few months of how to disappear into this chair at the end of the act, and how to, you know, pull a rat out of a box that someone had their hand in there before and there was nothing in there. You know, making sure that people pick kind of like these notes at random, but somehow still managing to figure out that the one of them was what the rat was in the box. So doing, you know, all this magic training. And so for the first time, I stand out on stage dressed as this witch, in front of Simon Cowell, Amanda, and you know, the others, and live in front of an audience on national television. Yeah. That was brown trousers time, that was.
Simon Cowell's reaction the whole time made me so happy because he was terrified.
He was, yeah. You know what? So he's a big softie, but yeah, I didn't get to speak to him much, to be honest. He tried to take the rat off me, actually, at one point, because he's a big animal lover.
Yeah.
And he wanted to hold the rat, and I didn't let him. I just gave him a dodgy look, and I ran after Amanda with it instead. And none of that was scripted. I mean, she ran off stage, you know. I was so tempted just to throw the rat at her, but I thought, I better not, or I'll get some animal cruelty people on my back, probably. You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She did not like the bugs when he squashed the apple either.
No. That act wasn't me.
Oh, really?
That was the audition. You see, that was the guy that had done the audition. So that particular one was the audition for the witch. But I was asked to come back, and I did a Christmas magic special, which you can probably find online if you haven't seen it. They did a Britain's Got Talent Ultimate Magician, and they put me on stage as the finale, which was amazing.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, Simon Cowell, he seems like he's just a character. Like, for instance, back in the day when he was doing, what's the name of that show? American Idol. When he was doing American Idol, he always played the prick, right? It's just like, dreadful, this sucks. Blah,
when he
blah,
was
blah.
Younger, yeah. I think things got a bit more PC. Obviously, American Idol, X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, you know, there was some very hurtful things said to a lot of contestants. And I think, obviously, as things started to progress, especially in this lovely woke day and age, that people started saying, you know what, this is wrong. And I've spoken to Simon. I've met Simon. He's very down to earth. He's very kind. He's a generous man. He's a very busy man, and he's a very sought after man. So he doesn't take any crap either. You know, fair play to him. I didn't expect him to. Otherwise, he'll never have any time to himself. You know, Amanda was lovely. David Walliams was amazing. Actually, he's such a funny guy. And Alicia Dixon actually messaged me privately afterwards and said thank you and all that kind of stuff. So that was wonderful.
Oh, that's really cool. That was really nice of her to do that.
Yeah.
So actually, I want to expand upon that then. Was your performance the reason why Scott Chambers hired you to be Peter Pan?
I think it was definitely an influence. I was actually recommended to Scott. Scott had put up a casting advert for the Peter Pan character, and he had a few hundred different applicants come in, and this is what he told me anyway, no one was really quite hitting the mark. But though he had a makeup artist that recommended me that I'd worked on another movie with called Gallowmere, which is a dark fantasy epic. And she goes, actually, I know this guy called Martin Portlock. He did the witch thing on that Britain's Got Talent thing and showed him the video. And he goes, all right, well, get him to send me a self-tape for this Peter Pan thing. Anyway, I did the self-tape for him. And then a day later, he calls me and we have a 2.5-hour conversation over the phone. And then a day after that, I had an email going, congratulations, the role's yours if you want it.
Oh, that's so cool.
I was really chuffed.
Oh, I bet. Corey, I think you have a question regarding that, right?
Yeah, actually. So how much creative freedom did Scott give you to become this horrific version of this beloved childhood character of Peter Pan?
So Scott he's quite a big advocate of people bringing elements to the character, because I think you've got to understand the character. And the one person that understands the character the most is the actor portraying that character when they get into that headspace. So Scott allowed me to have a degree of freedom. He wasn't strict in that respect. There were things that he definitely wanted me to say. There were things that he wanted me to do, but most of the time he was like, just let it flow. Let's see what we've got. But my idea for this scene is I want to keep it low key and creepy. And mm-hmm. That's all I needed to know. So then I could apply what I knew about my character and how I was feeling in that moment and give him different options. And that was a wonderful thing to work with.
Oh, that's great. And you know, when we watched it, your portrayal of Peter Pan, like we noticed shades of characters like Eric Draven from The Crow, Pennywise from mm-hmm. It, and mm-hmm. Heath Ledger's Joker.
What, yeah. This has been said to me a lot. And I've seen a lot of review videos online about this kind of thing. But when I went into doing this character, for example, the very first opening scene where you see Peter Pan come out of the trapdoor in the house, mm-hmm. Everyone's gone, oh, they're ripping off Pennywise. Look at this. It's obviously a Pennywise thing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking back to myself, I was like, well, maybe a little bit with the voice, but I'd say it's more of an Evil Dead ripoff, right?
No. Right.
And I was thinking people are just relating what they're seeing to other things they've seen. Personally, I don't think it necessarily means that it's been ripped off anything else. I never really had inspiration from any of those actors or characters for this role. I'm a massive advocate of creating something different and unique. I think it's generally only by fluke if it ever ends up being like something else in any one moment. The makeup for Peter Pan when he's in the circus is very crow-like, yes. Mm-hmm. And now looking back at the crow, I can kind of see that. And then people are like, oh, yeah, but he's got slick back hair. Now he's like the Joker. He's almost a bit like the Joaquin Phoenix Joker with his hair slicked back and he's got that makeup on.
Right.
And then his mannerisms, like there's a scene where I lick my lips a couple of times and they're like, oh, now he's Heath Ledger's Joker. And I'm like, well, I can't win it. I can't generate this character without obviously being labeled as something. But you know what? I've learned to take it as compliments. They're comparing me to some of the greatest actors and characters in history.
Exactly.
And I'm honored and I'm thrilled about that. But now those characters were never really an influence for myself. I was just trying to be true in the moment of the scene.
And like in that scene, you're just like, okay, I feel like going with these kind of mannerisms and this kind of style and like this way of speaking.
Exactly. And Peter Pan and the trapdoor, you know, the basement thing. I'm trying to entice the kid. So I'm talking like this to James. Hi, James. Would you like to come to Neverland with me? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's just like, how would you talk to a kid when you looked as horrific as you do to try and make him feel like you're friendly?
You've right, got to, you want a higher pitch yeah. voice.
How would a psycho adult try to speak to a child? You know, that's what I did in that scene. And he does it again a bit later in the movie when he's talking to the two kids in the bedroom, trying to make them feel comfortable.
Exactly. You don't want to go in with that low voice, right? That's like that menacing voice. You want to go in, hey, how's it going, kids?
That's
you almost want to sound like you're a kid show host. Or something like that.
Yeah. And something else that it did as well is that when Peter Pan changes and he becomes the, you know, I say, I'm going to take you now. That's it. My switch is flicked. I'm going to grab you. His mannerisms change. His voice changes. He's who he is, you know.
Yep. He's luring him in with a nice voice, a nice soothing, soft voice. And then when he's in that, like, that flip switch mode, that's when he starts changing, like, the lower tone, lower register.
Yeah, exactly,
and the rasp and everything.
Yeah.
So I get it. Do you think that people are looking for a comparison? Because let's be honest, Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare on paper does sound a little bit ridiculous. So people are probably looking for a way to like bash the movie. But obviously we love it. But I feel like if people saw this, they'd be like, oh, we're looking for something that they're trying to rip off or whatever.
I love the... Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. And I agree with you to an extent. I think, it's not my call, but I would love the movie to have been called Neverland Nightmare, and that's it. But for the Peter Pan genre and for a sales point of view, for distributors and all that kind of nonsense, you've got to have Peter Pan's name in it. And I think it works well as a good standalone horror. And the Peter Pan element is taken from, obviously, J.M. Barrie's original writings for the screenplay of Peter Pan. Mm-hmm. And Scott basically twisted it completely up on its head, flipped it on its head, said, we're going to do the same kind of story, same kind of characters, but we're going to throw them in a real world, a real situation. And Neverland is not a place they fly off to, but it's a place in this guy's head that nobody believes him.
Yeah, and see, we were thinking that when he strangles the kids and kills them, that their souls are going to Neverland, and then they obviously remain the same age because, well, that's the age at which they died. So if he's killing children, they'll be forever young as souls or whatever in Neverland.
Yeah,
so,
I think that is kind of the idea. And I think a lot of people kind of got that, you know, that, oh, I'm going to go and send you to Neverland now, you know.
Yeah.
And, but I'm not going to tell you I'm going to kill you, but I am actually helping you, you know. And he firmly believed it. And I think that makes the most scary psychopaths in the world, the ones that truly believe they're right when they're so very obviously wrong.
Yeah, and they think they're doing good, but in a sense is absolutely wrong.
They are the most dangerous people in the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think Thanos from the Avengers. So obviously Thanos decided he was going to wipe out half the world and thinking that it's going to help civilization, which I get it, but probably not the right way to go about it.
Don't murder billions of people with
that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Corey, you have a question.
So it's actually kind of related to what you were just talking about. So it was announced after Blood and Honey 2 that these childhood nightmare films are part of a bigger universe called the Pooniverse, similar to Marvel. Can you tell us anything about the plans for this universe? Have you seen any scripts?
I've spoken quite a bit with Scott about ideas for the Pooniverse movie. And I can't really tell you too much about it. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is you're looking at a movie that has an eclectic mix of all the heroes and villains that they've had previously brought into one film to create allies and enemies alike. So, you know, I mean, you put a group of bad guys in a room together, it's going to be bloodshed, or they're going to team up, or they're going to go into factions and fight for different reasons, right? So I would anticipate that Peter Pan is, I mean, he's not stupid, he's quite intelligent. I can imagine he's going to strike some kind of deal with some other guys in Pooniverse, and maybe to benefit them all. But they're also backstabbing murderers. So, you know, I wouldn't want to trust either of them, to be honest.
That's fair. You know, maybe he'll form these alliances to take on Hook.
Well, this
right?
is it. Yeah, well, this is it, you see. I think what's important to remember is that Scott and Reese have created a reimagining of different childhood stories that we've all come to know and love, and completely flip them on their head and creating a horror version. It doesn't mean necessarily that they've, you know, ruined it for anyone. I think if you feel that way, then don't go see the movie. Right. And also, this is something I'm quite passionate about, is being original. I think it was a great director. I think it was Quentin Tarantino who said that most stories have been told, but they've not been told the way you want to tell it. And I think it's exactly what Scott and Reese have done. They've grabbed the original writings for these characters, turned it around and telling it the way they would like to tell it. And it's exactly what Disney did. They took the original writings and created a character and told it the way they want to tell it for children. So Scott and Reese are now doing it for adults in a horror genre. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
You know, that's a good point. I mean, think Hook with Robin Williams and Dustin Hoffman. That's a retelling of that, too.
It is. So, it's like a post-Peter Pan movie, isn't it?
Yeah, post-Peter Pan. I'd say that, because that's when he's older, you know, and he's like he's married, he's got his own kids, and then those kids get kidnapped into Neverland, that type deal.
Yeah. And if you think about Captain Hook, I love Captain Hook. Like, he was my first ever stage role. I played Captain James Hook.
Really?
It was one of my first ever stage gigs, yeah. So getting to play Peter Pan was unique. So if you think about Hook himself, James Hook, he lives in Neverland on the Jolly Roger with all his pirate buddies. They live in their little seaside town. Come along a load of bloody teenagers murdering the pirates and pillaging the flipping town and stealing them and calling him a codfish, throwing him to the crocodile, feeding his hand to the crocodile. You know, he's got bloodlust for these kids. And it makes you kind of wonder that there's a bunch of children flying around without consequence that need to be taught. And they need parents, but they don't have any. So Hook is the only one there in charge to try and police this thing. So who's the bad guy? Who's the good guy in this?
Oh, that's a good point. Those kids are running amok. And they're just doing whatever. Like you said, flying around, raising all sorts of hell. And poor
Hook.
That's why
James in Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare is a victim. He's the little boy from the circus. Was James Hook.
I noticed that. See, Corey, I told you. It's
yeah,
like
we talked
kid
about
from
it.
The circus. Yep. And yeah, he obviously had his hand cut off, and a Hook was put there instead. And I'm not going to give away too much, because, you know, we want people to obviously see the movie. But that's what I was thinking, because they showed the photo of that kid. I'm like, it has to be Hook. Like, Hook and that kid have to be the same exact thing. Now, how he became Hook, we can only speculate, because I'm thinking that's really saved till the next movie. Or, you know, the sequel, and where maybe Scott will expand upon that. But, I mean,
possibly.
I guess only time will tell.
Possibly. You're asking the wrong person. I know nothing.
Well, yeah, you know a little thing or two, but you just can't give away too much.
Exactly, yeah.
And I get it. Yeah, you got to keep things secret, and, you know, otherwise people will take shit. I mean, I'm not going to make a Peter Pan movie, so you don't have to worry about that. But, yeah, we're looking forward to the sequel. And just to kind of circle back here regarding this movie, so when we were watching it, we thought this movie was like leaps and bounds better than what we expected. And we were thinking, like, if you had this like movie in theaters with the same kind of budget of, let's say, Smile, right? You know, like with that kind of marketing budget, we think that this could go toe-to-toe with one of those bigger horror movies with a bigger budget.
Yeah. I think there were a few things that they would have liked to have done. I think the movie would have been extended slightly as well. And I, you know, I've got to hand it to them that the minimal CGI movies are wonderful. As I said, I was always a big fan growing up of the practical effects, you know, like, as I said, like Gremlins and all that kind of stuff. And that's what they've done in this movie. You know, I've been working with the prosthetic studio run by Sean Harrison and Paul and Booker Harrison. And they did all of the prosthetics and all of the little anything to do with blood and guts and gore in this movie. They did everything. And they're absolutely fantastic. And they've done some great work on Harry Potter, Sleepy Hollow. They've done loads of Tim Burton stuff. So they had a great team. And I think with a bigger budget, they could have really brought something extra to the movie, more about Neverland, more about the dream sequences, the drug addictions. I think they could have really expanded at the movie with a bigger, bigger budget. But this is the blessing and curse of indie filmmaking. Is you want to make a movie and you've got a budget to do that movie, but your hands are tied into certain things that you can do. But managing to adapt and overcome and create those wonderful elements and end up coming up with a movie like Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare is a great achievement.
Absolutely is. It's amazing the practical effects we were raving about in this movie, because it's so realistic. The makeup is great and nothing felt like hokey or anything like that. I mean, obviously we did have a question regarding Peter Pan's face not being smashed to smithereens by Michael, but other than that, everything just looked great. And we prefer the practical effects because sometimes you can just tell when things are CGI and you're like, oh, you know, it's not that great. Practical effects, kind of hard to have anyone really question that stuff. They watch and they go, oh, that was sick. You know, it's or if it's absolutely hokey practical effects, then it's almost comical. So
yeah.
I think you're better off doing practical over CGI.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a couple of moments where I think the only couple of bits of CGI that are actually in the film is the storybook at the beginning and the bits where he sees his shadow, obviously. I think that's about it, because all of the other gore effects and everything like that, they're all real.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, I was covered in blood like 70% of the time I was shooting that film. It was in my eyes, it was in my mouth, it was up my nose. And that's just me, not my victims. Yeah, all the guts were everywhere. I mean, we were on the kitchen floor in Peter Pan's house and it was freezing. And Kit Green, who plays Tinkerbell, was led on the floor with her limbs kind of everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
And she was freezing. Like, she was covered in blood, wet. She did get the worst.
I thought the mother in the beginning with the meat tenderizer was bad, but then it got to that scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the scalping. I'm watching and going, oh my God.
It was cringy, but in a good way. Like, it made you squirm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was enjoying it. And not as Martin, but as Peter. You know, he was getting his revenge in that scalping moment. And you can see that in his face. And I'm very proud of that little cut where you can just see him, like, looking down and kind of, like, enjoying it as he's pulling it back. And I was very proud of that little moment.
It is such a gnarly moment. I mean, that's within the first few minutes of a movie. We talk about selling a movie. You're like, oh, okay, here's an insanely gruesome death off the bat.
Well, there's your hook for the film.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Oh, I was going to say pun intended. But speaking of horror, Corey, you have a question about horror.
So what's it like filming a horror movie as compared to other genres? Do the sets feel different?
No, the sets don't really feel different. We're all there to do the same kind of job. You know, whether I'm acting a psychopath or a gentleman or a lover, you know, I think you've still got a job to do as an actor. You've still got the same kind of crew around you. It's the same kind of working environment. What is more difficult is the emotionally draining aspect, I think. As an actor, as Peter Pan, I really struggled on set sometimes with being that character for long periods of time, or being around people that I'd been attacking all day and looking as gruesome as I did. I remember there's this one time we were on lunch and I was dressed up in my full getup, makeup, everything. And I went to the bathroom, right? And I looked in the mirror and I just could not look at myself. I felt so self-conscious. But that was like a reaction to everything I'm doing, you know, in that kind of situation. I mean, I'm strangling children, I'm chopping people up, I'm scalping people, I'm stabbing people, I'm gutting people. I'm pointing at children sadistically to choose my next victim, and I'm trying to, you know, talk about my mother and not well up with tears in my eyes and stuff like that. It was such an emotional journey for that character. It was very, very difficult not to lose yourself in that.
Oh, yeah, and I can definitely see that. I mean, let's say just wearing a costume, right? Let's say you're at a Halloween party and you're wearing this costume. You go to the bathroom and you look at yourself in the mirror. It is not yourself. It is not what you're used to seeing. So it's so different. And I can only imagine, like, the heightened version of wearing the prosthetics and just seeing this completely different being wearing your skin, basically.
Yeah, man. There's one scene. You remember the scene where I've got Michael on the floor? I got my hands around his neck.
Yeah.
Okay. We went at that for a good few takes. Mm-hmm. And I was not really choking Peter. That was his name, by the way. That was confusing too. So I'm there with my hands around Peter's neck.
Yep.
And we're going for it in this scene. It wasn't a difficult thing to do, but it was a difficult thing for me to watch myself do through my eyes. You know, I don't know, you close your eyes at night and all you see is a picture of his little face looking up at you, getting strangled by your hands. That imagery is something that I really struggled with afterwards. Because I'm a father of three. I've got three children.
Oh, wow.
And your mind knows it's not real. But I think sometimes your body forgets. So you can give yourself like an aftershock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like watching a load of disturbed stuff for a long period of time. It will affect you. But then I'm an actor and I had to put myself in that position. And I had to really kind of get that emotion going to bring that character to life, you know. And then as soon as the cameras were off, it's switched straight back to Martin again. And now I can get out of the makeup and now I can just be me again. That's absolutely fine. But while you're doing it, it was probably one of the most difficult things I've ever had to do.
Oh, I could only imagine the sight. Like just having that image burned in your head of like strangling a child and looking down. That's got to be difficult. But
you know what? We got on and we had a laugh between takes. We did have a laugh.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure he strangled you back or whatever, and you're like, okay, fine. we'll change. I'll be the kid. You can strangle me. And then, or whatever. I don't know. Corey, well, actually, you kind of have a question regarding the personal effects.
Yeah, so I was just curious if you can tell us about anything that you carry with you to everything that you film, like personal effects that you can't live without while you're filming a movie or a television show.
Well, that's a really good question. I've never been asked that before. What do I take? My phone. No, I think everyone takes your phone. I think I have, like, I always take an unusual copy of the script, like one that's kind of just mine that I've just had ever since the beginning, just in case, in my bag, just in case I need it for some silly reason. And personal effects, this is really weird. I always take chewing gum. I always make sure I've got, like, these minty chewing gums. Wherever I go, I always make sure there's some in my bag. Along with this, this is going to sound really weird. I have this really special lip balm. It's like a strawberry-flavored lip balm, which I cannot go anywhere without. Because if I'm out and about and I've got dry lips, I cannot stand it. So I have to kind of like put this lip balm on just to make sure that they don't go sore for anything that I'm doing and come up bright red or something. That's a bit of a weird thing, actually. Now I'm thinking about it, I've got some weird habits.
Yeah. Hey, I get it. I always have chapstick on me. You know how gross it is to have like crusty ass chapped lips? You're just walking around and people have to look at that? No. I make sure my lips are nice and, I don't know, not lipsticked up, but chapped up. Chapped up? No, I don't know. I just make sure there's chapstick on them.
What's the brand of chapstick you use? I've never heard of strawberry chapstick. I need to find some.
Yeah, I think it's called, I think that's actually what it's called, chapstick.
Oh.
It's probably a UK brand, you know?
Okay, so it's just a flavor of strawberry?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'm going to have to see if I can find some.
It's good.
You know what, Martin? I'll do you one better. Sometimes I actually put on a lip mask at night.
What the hell is that?
All right. So think of like chapstick that sits on your lips all night and just keeps your lips hydrated as fuck.
What?
And it's watermelon. it's watermelon flavored.
So yeah, just imagine you need that like while you're just sleeping.
Sometimes my lips are just so chapped. I'm like, now time to bring out the big guns. And, I put on a lip mask or something.
Sometimes I use the blood of my enemies.
That would probably be a little bit more believable as opposed to a lip mask.
No, in all honesty, I don't have many things. I'm a minimalist. So I'll have a bag, you know, with a few sets of clothes and a wash bag. And I think if I can travel one end of the country and back again with just one bag, that's me. I'm not like a three suitcases kind of guy, you know.
That's impressive. I did kind of the same deal when I went to Ireland with the family. I had one little carry-on thing that had all my clothes in it, and I packed like a son of a bitch, right? And I'm watching all these people. They're all checking their luggage. They got these like things all over the place. And they're like, how the hell did you pull that off? I'm like, I don't pack like an idiot. I just try to be simple and just grab what I need and compress. That's all. And hey, sometimes it's better to just be like a minimalist. And I wish I could implement more of that into my life. But I like having a lot of horror memorabilia around my house.
That's amazing. I've got a couple of questions for you guys.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll start with yourself. Favorite horror film, go.
Favorite horror film.
Five,
I'm going to go with Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives.
Okay, cool. How about yourself, man?
Yeah, the same one, Friday the 13th, Part 6.
Oh, come on.
All right, Jason Takes Manhattan.
Ooh, okay.
It's a fun one.
See, I'm old school. Mine would have to be Evil Dead 2.
Ah, that's a good one. That was a very good one.
It'd have to, only because of the, you know, Sam Raimi. I think he's such a great director. Bruce Campbell, such a character. And the effects, the story, you know, everything about that film, I think, is genuine and original. And I love it.
Oh, it's great. You know, I think a number two for me would be Scream. I think.
Really?
Yeah.
I was never really a big fan of Scream, you know. There's a lot of hype about Scream, and I was never really like, I was a bit like, I think I prefer Texas Chainsaw Massacre to something like this.
Yeah.
Well, you know?
Yeah, that's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it. Scream, there's so much hype over it, and yes, it makes sense why people would be like, I'm not watching it because that's the popular one, whatever. But I think just storytelling-wise, it is next level for horror. And that's what I love about it.
I watched in my living room on a projector with full surround sound at 3 a.m. with all the lights off in a bungalow on my own. I watched the very first Paranormal Activity.
I fucking love it.
And
did
I
you sleep that
myself.
Night?
No, did I fuck? I was all the lights on, listening to music till the sun came up, and then I went to bed. That was an experience, you know. I think that those kind of genre of film, you've got to watch them in the right environment for them to have the biggest impact.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you how you felt about The Exorcist.
Which one? The first one?
The very first one, like Linda Blair Exorcist.
It's a classic. And I actually rewatched it again the other night, along with Pope's Exorcist, because Peter DeSarzo-Fahoney, who played Michael in Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare, is the kid in The Pope's Exorcist with Russell Crowe.
Oh, no shit. It didn't even dawn on me.
Yeah, so I watched his performance in that, and then I messaged him afterwards and saying, mate, I've just watched it. Well done. That was epic.
I love that movie, too. That's a good one.
We actually think we did an episode on that.
We
did the other one.
If you didn't, get Peter on. He'd do an interview with you.
Oh, that'd be fun.
If we can find out how to reach him, sure.
Yeah, man. I'll tell you what. I'll ping you his details after.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, but no worries. I liked it. Oh, that's right. I'm looking at it now. Yep. Okay, I see it. I love the Pope's Exorcist. What's the other one that we watched?
I think it was The Exorcist.
Oh, The Exorcist, as opposed to The Pope's Exorcist. Two different movies. They have no relation.
Russell Crowe.
Yeah, The Exorcist or whatever, Pope's Exorcist.
The Exorcism is what it was called.
Pope's Exorcism or whatever.
No,
it
the
was
one
fine.
We did is the Pope's Exorcism. The Exorcism.
Okay, The Exorcism. It's confusing. No, because they're very confusing. We had a whole discussion about how they didn't even relate, and it was just very freaking confusing between the two of them.
It's all right. Don't worry. It'll get worse. They'll create another movie soon called The Pope and the Exorcist. just to really confuse people. Yeah, just to really throw it.
Let's not put that out in the universe, because it seems like whenever we talk about something like this, it happens. They're going to just merge the two. And I don't know. That'd be funny. So, yeah, we got a few more questions for you. When you're not acting, what do you do in your spare time?
Well, as I said a little earlier, I'm a father of three.
Yep.
So when I'm not acting, I'm usually spending quite a bit of time with them. But when I'm not, you know, if I'm doing something at home, like hobby-wise, actually, I don't mind fishing. I go fishing sometimes. I like to fish.
Yeah.
I find it very peaceful. I do a bit of gardening. I play a bit of guitar. I like to swim. I write. God, do I write. I write scripts. I'm working on a script at the moment for a film that we're hoping to make in the next year or so called Cauldron. So you can kind of imagine what that might be about.
Witches?
But really cool witches. Yeah. Like, let me talk to you a little bit about Cauldron, because it's I'm quite passionate about it at this moment in time.
Yeah, definitely.
So if I was to say to you, give me three stereotypical things that you would expect a witch to do.
Cast a spell.
Okay, cool.
Have a cauldron where you like throw in all sorts of ingredients. Okay. And summon some sort of being from the woods.
And has a talking cat.
A talking cat. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So in our day and age and the way we've kind of all grown up and evolved, we see witches as women with pointy hats, green skin, warts, fly on sticks, brooms. They cackle in the night. They mostly come out at Halloween, usually got a black cat and a cauldron where they make spells. They can turn people into frogs. They give people poison apples, all that kind of stuff, right?
Right.
So this film is about, if witches were real, they wouldn't really be anything like that. But what if they did some of the same things that we've all come to know about witches? For example, a witch turning somebody into a frog. It wouldn't use a wand or just wave its hand to turn someone into a frog. This witch that we're writing about jumps on top of this guy, shoves a potion down his throat. The man graphically turns into a frog in pain and anguish. And then she just stamps on it afterwards. You know, it's
all
like
right.
How, it, why, you know, add in the reasons why you would want to turn someone into a frog, as well as just turning someone into a frog, you know, to make them weaker so you can just crush them like a bug.
Yeah, or eat them, like frog legs or something.
Or eat them, whatever.
Yeah.
So what we've done is we've made some of the classic ideas of what people think of witches and the things that witches do, and we've put them into a real world situation of the hows and whys that people would do some such things.
All right, that's really cool. Yeah, I could get behind that. I know, like, the last time I really seen a movie where witches weren't, like, portrayed to be, like, your generic style witch, maybe The Craft.
Yeah. Yes, more teenage witches, right?
Yeah, more like goth kids who did, like, some witchy stuff, but never, like, turned people to frogs or anything like that. They just did sort of spells for someone to fall in love with them or someone to lose their hair or whatever.
But we've done this. We're writing this through time. So I think the film starts in 1610. And the whole ethos with the story of the witches is that a witch without a coven gets locked inside a cauldron, a bit like a genie in the bottle kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the whole idea for a witch is to make sure that their coven is big and strong. But when one loses all of their coven and they're the last remaining witch, gets locked inside the cauldron. Cauldron's kind of indestructible. It gets handed down through time, ends up in a basement of an old family in the 1990s.
Okay, so how would you then reactivate the witch, I guess?
Yeah, well, spoilers.
No, okay, no. No, okay, we won't give it away.
So, you know, I think, so that's the concept. This witch ends up popping out of the cauldron and then converting people as quick as possible, but ends up targeting this family and the young boy that lives with this family as its first target. Well, I can't really tell you much more, but that's the movie we're working on at the moment. That's what we're writing, and it's proven to be really cool. In fact, what I might do, because I think I've got your email address, I'll send you some concept art.
I would love to see that. Yeah,
I'll send you some concept art.
Definitely send that on over our way. We'd love to see that stuff.
Sure, man.
Yeah. One last question. And this is basically about your future. Well, actually two, really. One's going to be more about like your future. And another one is for you promoting what you have coming up. The first one is, what director or actor do you see yourself wanting to work with someday?
Actors, there are so many. I'd love to work with Andrew Scott. I don't know if you're familiar with
I do know Andrew Scott.
I met Andrew on set a few years ago in a Shrewsbury prison where they were filming it was a comedy about a politician that went to jail, funnily enough.
Yeah.
And I was speaking to him on set and I got a real feel for the guy. He's a massive professional. I love his work. And it's always been an ambition for me to end up working with that guy and acting alongside him. So that's something that I've, you know, has always been an ambition. Director-wise, in all honesty, I'm not fussed. I think if the script is silver-lined and enthralls me to the character, whether it be an indie project or a high-end industry project, I will always be on board. I think one of my favorite characters that I would ever like to play would be something like the Doctor in Doctor Who, funnily enough.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
I would love to do that, actually. A lot of people think, Martin, you're a bit creepy to play that role. I said, have you seen some of the Doctors?
I have. So, they're a little creepy looking. Hey, I don't think it's out of the cards for you.
No, I got Tom Baker's nose, man. I got Tom Baker's nose. Yeah. I got his schnoz.
So, like, for me, let's say if there was an actor I'd want to work with someday, maybe Daniel Day-Lewis.
Oh, nice.
Who is a master of the craft. That guy is just comes out, wins an Oscar, leaves, just does it every once in a while.
Yeah, there was a series that I watched the other week called Midnight Mass. Have you ever watched that?
Oh, yeah, Netflix. That's great.
Yeah, it is very good, isn't it? And there's one particular cast member, and his name is Rahul. So he plays the priest. And I think he is one of the best actors I've seen in a very, very long time. He played every line so natural, rolled off. He used his little Meisner technique. Every mannerism that he did was true to his character. And I've not seen that happen in an actor for years. So I think very highly of that guy.
Well, one could debate the same with you, because you had... I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass here. not trying to blow smoke up your ass, but I'm just saying, like, I saw your performance and I was like, shit, this guy's got it. This is one hell of a performance. Like,
oh, thanks, man. You're making me blush. You can't see it, but I'm not going to be able to go to bed tonight. My missus won't be able to get next to my massive head.
Just dragging it into your bedroom.
Now you're just making me want to see you something. You work with Mike Flanagan.
Yeah,
imagine that.
Oh man,
because he's like a master right now in the genre.
Yeah, I'd love to.
But yeah, as I'm watching it, I'm like, you know, this could really open some doors for this guy just on the performance alone. And if the movie, let's say the movie wasn't that great, right, the most redeeming factor was your performance, because it was believable. Very, very believable.
You know, that's how a lot of actors work, you know, my friend.
They try to be believable?
They do their job. They try in. They go in. They do the job. They do it to the best of their ability. And even if the film's crap, as long as that actor knows that their performance was good and they did the best they could do, then they're always going to be happy, whether the film is a flop or is a massive success. Because as an actor, you've got no control over the other creative elements of the movie. So you kind of trust the people around you for it to work. But all you can do is get your head down and do the best you can do.
Yeah, exactly. It could be like editing, right? Everything could be perfect. And then you throw that thing in editing and someone butchers it.
Absolutely.
Now you have a movie that's not that great.
Yeah, and absolutely.
It happens all the time. Luckily, none of that happened for this movie. But now I think we can actually just get wrapped up here. I know it's late and you can take your ginormous head at this point and go to bed if you can.
It's all right. Thanks, man. I'm going to get a coffee. I've had a couple of ideas for this cauldron since we were talking, so I'm going to do a bit of writing, I think.
Perfect. I hope that we added to that a little bit. Or that's my ego being like, yeah, we helped.
Yeah.
So is there anything coming up that you would like to promote, maybe other than The Cauldron?
So I did mention that we wrapped on a feature film called Gallowmere, which is a dark fantasy epic. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have a look on my social media, you'll be able to see different and a trailer. There is actually a trailer out at the moment. So if you go on my Instagram and watch that trailer, you'll see what it's all about. But it's a very kind of Lord of the Rings-esque. The director is a big Lord of the Rings fan. And although he hasn't copied, you know, anything from Lord of the Rings, he has made his own dark fantasy epic with that kind of Tolkien feel to the movie. And I was very fortunate to play one of the lead roles as one of the mages in the film. And it's very character driven. It's a very humbling story about a being who's struggling to defeat an entity, because there were three of him, now there's only one. How can he defeat it again? You know, the last time he fought this big evil, he lost two of his kin, and he pulls on the help of his mortal friends, you know, about three or four humble people that end up becoming the heroes of the movie. So it's a great watch, actually. So that's hopefully going to be coming out soon. It is in post-production at the moment, but if anyone's interested in that kind of genre, then do check it out.
Oh, for sure. I'm actually watching the trailer right now. I'm watching it on mute, so I'll watch it like with actual volume later. I didn't want it picking up over the mic and stuff.
Yeah, so. No worries. Yeah. I mean, if you like it, I'm sure the guys will do a podcast with you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, hey, we could do like a kind of a one-off and be like, let's do a Gjallmir special. Yeah.
They'd like that.
That'd be fun. So, Martin, thank you so much again for sitting with us today and having this amazing discussion. Now, one thing I did want to know, though, that maybe you can just tell everyone, is there anywhere that people can see Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare?
Okay. So, I believe in the U.S., it's already out. It's already been in theaters, and I think it's on VOD now. Mm-hmm. Here in the UK, the Blu-ray is actually being released this Monday, and video on demand. You can pick up the movie at HMV or on Amazon. I think that's it, really. I think most streaming services will probably have it. I don't think it's on Netflix, but, you know, give it time. You never know with Netflix, do you?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but yeah, I think you can probably find it on a lot of video on demand, Apple TV and Amazon.
Awesome. Yeah, Martin, thank you so much again for sitting with us. We loved Peter Pan's Neverland Nightmare, so we wanted to get you on here, you know, promote the movie, get people excited for the film, as excited as we were for it. So thank you again. It means so much to us. Like,
it's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you.
Oh, great, guys. Thank you so much anyway. It's been great. It's been fun. It's been informative.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Martin.
I would like to say one thing that I touched up on earlier, if I may.
Sure, of course.
There was a question that was brought to me about how I started acting. If any of you feel like you're in that position where you feel like you're stuck in a dead-end job and you've always wanted to do something creative, or you've always wanted to be an actor, a musician, anything like that, just do it. Don't let it lie, because you'll never forgive yourself later in life if you don't start.
Well, I guess I'm quitting my job tomorrow.
Me too.
Well, no, don't quit your job. Just apply yourself to what you want to do and research it and look into it and start that ball rolling.
Awesome. Thank you for the advice.
Because, yeah, I feel the same way at the moment. You know, I do tech support, and it's not really filling my cup. It's not what I want to do. I always want to do something creative with my life.
Then do it. Figure out what that creativity is, what would fulfill you, and just start looking it up. Find communities, local people that do the same thing, even if it's an amateur thing. You know, like I first started, I went into amateur dramatics. I found the local community that started acting, and that's where I started building from. And then I moved forwards and I grew. So that's what you've got to do. Start small, baby steps, but do it.
See, that's good. I'm like one of those guys, like, I'm just going to go all in. But no, I have to do baby steps.
Yeah.
Find like-minded people and find my community and work from there.
That's it.
Baby steps is the important thing. Just make the step.
That's it. That's your bit of advice from Peter Pan. There you go.
Thank you, Peter Pan.
Baby steps.
Baby steps. All right, everyone. Be sure to like, follow, and subscribe on Facebook, X, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, and YouTube. Leave us a 5-star review on all podcast platforms so we can get some more exposure. Of course, tell your friends. Both our intro and outro music are courtesy of Andrew Scott Bell. Be sure to check out Andrew on all major streaming platforms. And if you see Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey on vinyl in the wild, be sure to pick it up. We're also part of the Shining Wizards Network. Be sure to visit ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. They're an awesome podcast network ranging from wrestling to heavy metal, horror, all that good stuff. So check that out. Visit 30ScreamsOrLess.com for all previous episodes and transcripts to go with those episodes. Also, check out beardoctane.com for their whole line of grooming supplies, and be sure to use the code 30screams10 at checkout for 10% off your order. And if there's anything you want us to review, send an email to 30screamsorless@gmail.com or hit us up on social media. Use hashtag 30screamsorless. And also, we have some awesome merch for sale on our website, so definitely check that out. If you go to our website, at the very top, there's a shop link. Click that link, and you'll see all sorts of shirts, hats, mugs, things like that. If you buy it, it helps going towards our hosting costs. I'm Steve.
I'm Corey.
And thanks for listening to 30 Screams or Less. And don't forget to drink your beans.